Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
The Fish Commission is heartened to see the federal government stand up to protect salmon and the importance of federal management.
The federal government sues the state of Alaska over its management of Kuskokwim salmon fishing. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 18th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, clean water advocates hope for new PFAS regulations by the end of the legislative session.
There are communities from the north slope of Alaska all the way down through southeast that have contaminated drinking water.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you are a hunter, birder, or outdoor enthusiast, the U.S. Geological Survey is asking for help tracking the bird populations in Alaska. The USGS manages a nationwide bird banding program, and every year, thousands of birds are marked with small, numbered leg bands. If you see, find, or harvest a banded bird, please report the band number online at reportband.gov. The information provided will help inform how bird populations may be changing. This message sponsored by the USGS Alaska Science Center.
The federal government is suing the state of Alaska over its management of king and chum salmon fishing on the Kuskokwim River in the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge. At issue is whether rural subsistence users have a preference when fish are scarce, or whether that preference should go to all Alaskans wherever they live. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
The lawsuit says the state is violating a 1980 federal land law. The Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act specifies that a preference is granted to rural residents when there isn't enough fish to go around. And there hasn't been. For years, the state and federal governments have both managed fisheries in the refuge, which covers virtually all of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Sometimes their rules conflict. For instance, in June of 2021, the state declared the lower Kuskokwim open to subsistence gillnets, while federal managers said it was closed to protect the resource. Kevin Whitworth is interim director of the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission. He sees the lawsuit as beneficial to tribes and rural residents.
The Fish Commission is disheartened to see the federal government basically stand up to protect salmon and the importance of federal management.
State Assistant Attorney General Grace Lee says the state's management is based on sound science with input from local stakeholders. The dispute has been brewing for decades because federal law requires a rural subsistence preference, and the state Supreme Court said in 1989 that state law doesn't allow it. The lawsuit was filed Tuesday in U.S. District Court in Anchorage. It names Fish and Game Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang and his department as defendants. The state is again forecasting below average salmon runs on the Kuskokwim this season and poor chum runs. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska lawmakers are facing the end of the regular legislative session with a state spending package that is still not resolved. House and Senate negotiators reached a tentative agreement yesterday that would pay residents more than $3,000. But the final amount would depend on whether the legislature can muster the votes needed to access a budget reserve account. The agreement must be taken up by the House and Senate. Today marked the constitutional legislative meeting limit of 121 days, though there is an option to extend it up to 10 days. Senate President Peter Michicki says lawmakers have been treating today as though it's the session's last day. Two bills that would tighten regulations on the group of chemicals known as PFAS are stalled in committee as Alaska's legislative session draws to a close. As KTOO's Claire Strempel reports, that would send lawmakers back to square one and leave clean water advocates high and dry for another year.
PFAS have been linked to cancer, liver damage, fertility problems, asthma, and thyroid disease. Activists rallied for the bills at the Capitol last week.
We're here for a call to action.
Pamela Miller leads Alaska Community Action on Toxics. She's supporting the bills, introduced by Representative Sarah Hannan and Senator Jesse Keel, that would also limit the use of firefighting foams that are known to contain PFAS.
So we think it's high time that these bills be passed to protect our Alaska communities. There are communities from the North Slope of Alaska all the way down through Southeast that have contaminated drinking water because of this dispersive use of these chemicals in industrial firefighting foams used on airports and on military bases.
Sarah Thomas joined the rally to advocate for her hometown of Utqiagvik, where firefighting foams at a naval base contaminated drinking water at Immokpuk Lake.
I know too many people who have passed away from cancer in their 20s. People who have been on thyroid medication since their teens, things that are not normal, and we're seeing way too much of it.
Those foams were also the source of contamination around a state-run airport in Gustavus, where the state supplies bottled water to residents like Joanne Lesh, whose wells have been poisoned with toxic runoff.
Okay, I'm the face of it. I'm the face of PFAS.
Lesh and her husband ran an inn at what's basically the gateway to the Glacier Bay National Park, where they served patrons fresh food from their garden. She said discovering the water and soil on their property is contaminated was devastating.
We moved there for everything to be pristine, the organic garden, and everything is now polluted.
Senator Jesse Keel represents Gustavus. He says the state's regulatory agency, the Department of Environmental Conservation, doesn't do enough to protect Alaskans from PFAS.
The problem of these PFAS chemicals, these are forever chemicals. They don't break down, they don't go away, and they are in Alaskans' drinking water.
He says his bill would do the bare minimum to protect Alaskans' drinking water and ensure the toxic firefighting foams aren't widely used in the state any longer. He and Representative Sarah Hannan say there's money to enact their legislation in a federal infrastructure bill. The state's Department of Environmental Conservation raised a number of concerns about the legislation. DEC once regulated PFAS to higher standards, but rolled them back following political pressure. Tiffany Larson directs the Division of Spill Prevention and Response at DEC. She says the state defers to the federal government, specifically the Environmental Protection Agency, on the question of PFAS.
DEC is saying we will follow EPA when they come out with new drinking water standards. Because they have the resources and have been able to invest that sort of effort into that.
But Representative Hannan says the federal government isn't moving fast enough.
We should not and cannot afford for our health to wait for the federal action to clean this up.
It would be difficult to pass the bills in the remaining hours of the legislative session. And if they don't pass, legislators say they will try again next year. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Claire Stremple.
Beginning today, Alaska residents impacted by this month's flooding can register for funding to offset the cost of damages and flood-related expenses. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur has the details.
Governor Mike Dunleavy declared a disaster after ice jams caused flooding at Manly Hot Springs. Later, he added other communities where flooding also occurred, including Sleepmute, Red Devil, McGrath, and Glen Allen. The disaster declaration made funding available for residents of these communities to apply for to help pay for damages and other flood-related expenses. Funding is available to pay for three different needs. First, to pay for the cost of temporary housing while people look for permanent housing. The amount available is determined by family size and local housing cost. Second, individuals or families can receive up to nearly $19,000 to pay for home damages that are not covered by insurance. Third, individuals or families can receive up to nearly $19,000 to pay for a broad range of flood-related expenses. This includes damages to personal property, like clothing, appliances, vehicles, and subsistence equipment. It includes reimbursement for cleanup and storage expenses. It can also be used to pay for medical and funeral expenses that are not covered by insurance. Residents in affected communities can begin registering for the funding today. The deadline to register is July 12th. Residents can register online for state flood disaster assistance at www.ready.alaska.gov or by calling 907-428-7072 or 907-428-7075. The state asks residents to be prepared to provide a description of damages and losses, home ownership documentation, insurance information, personal identification, and proof of occupancy, such as a utility bill. For KYUK, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Pebble Mine opponents ask the Environmental Protection Agency to protect Bristol Bay.
Our salmon is just not our salmon. We are people that live on the land, and I believe that we are protectors of that salmon because that salmon belongs to America.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
People who smoke or have smoking-related conditions like lung and heart disease are more likely to get seriously ill from COVID-19. Not using any tobacco or e-cigarette products is one of the best ways to keep your immune system strong, ready to fight all kinds of viruses. If you decide to quit, help is available. Call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or text READY to 200-400 to get the support you need to quit for good. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line.
Alaska state troopers say a 7-year-old Kodiak boy whose body was found after being missing for a week died from hypothermia. Sawyer Sipola went missing May 7th, and his body was found by people recreating on Pillar Mountain on Sunday. Today, troopers said there were no signs or indications of foul play or suspicious circumstances. Troopers said preliminary information from the state medical examiner corroborates the findings, and troopers have closed their investigation. The search for Sipola included about 2,500 volunteers, law enforcement, military, and first responders. They searched an area covering more than 15 square miles. A coalition of Pebble Mine opponents traveled to Washington, D.C. last week. Their goal was to push the Environmental Protection Agency to permanently protect Bristol Bay against future developments like the proposed Pebble Mine. KDLG's Izzy Ross has more.
The Pebble deposit is a vast store of copper, gold, and molybdenum that sits at the headwaters of Bristol Bay. For almost two decades, activists from around the region and the country have worked to stop the construction of an open-pit mine there. This month, they hope the EPA will take a step closer to long-term protections against the development. Representatives with the United Tribes of Bristol Bay and a national group of commercial fishermen met with members of Congress and the Environmental Protection Agency last week with a request to permanently block development of the Pebble Deposit under the Clean Water Act. At a press conference in front of the United States Capitol building, Thomas Tilden, a chief of the Choryong Tribal Council, says they came to ask the feds to use their authority to protect Bristol Bay's salmon from the threat posed by the mine.
Our salmon is just not our salmon. We are people that live on the land, and I believe that we are protectors of that salmon because that salmon belongs to America. When you look at how many people utilize, 50% of the salmon that is in America comes from our waters. Our waters are pristine, plentiful, and that's what nourishes that salmon so well.
Tilden and others are pushing so hard for protections in the region because the EPA is expected to take the next step in the veto process against Pebble by the end of the month. Here's how that process works. Section 404 of the Clean Water Act is the federal law that regulates how the nation's wetlands and waterways are developed. The EPA can use part of that law to veto development in those wetlands if it determines that it would cause unacceptable damage to water supplies or wildlife habitat. In the next 2 weeks, the EPA will issue an initial proposal on how to restrict or totally deny mining of the Pebble deposit. That's called a proposed determination, or preemptive veto. That's followed by a public comment period. Then the EPA's regional administrator recommends whether to move forward with the veto. The United Tribes of Bristol Bay says they expect the EPA to release its proposed determination by May 26th. They are hoping for a final determination by the end of the year. At last week's press conference, California Democratic Representative Jared Huffman says he joined the Alaska Coalition to tell the EPA to block developments like Pebble in Bristol Bay.
administrations can change, politics can change. And so with something as critical to the economy of Alaska, to the way of life of the people in Bristol Bay in Alaska, something as critical as this Bristol Bay watershed, you just can't afford to leave that to chance. You gotta finish the job.
A big talking point was the upcoming sockeye salmon season. More than 73 million salmon are expected to return to the bay this summer. Michael Jackson, with the organization Commercial Fishermen for Bristol Bay, says the EPA should act to protect those record runs.
Let me tell you how record. Last year, over 66 million fish returned. This year, 73.4 million are forecast to return.
Pebble Limited Partnership spokesperson Mike Heatwell says he doesn't expect the result of the proposed determination to be good for Pebble or other potential mines in the area.
We're waiting to see primarily what ultimately the EPA will roll into that proposed determination. As you know, the devil's always in the details.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers denied Pebble's federal permit proposal in November of 2020. Heatwell says the company is working with the Corps on an appeal of that decision, which it filed last year. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
Two times every year, volunteers from around the Kenai Peninsula grab their waders and gloves and head to the Kenai River. They're collecting samples that will help paint a picture of how the river's doing in that moment in time. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
Like any good patient, the Kenai River gets an annual checkup. That's the analogy that environmental scientist Ben Meyer uses to explain the Kenai Watershed Forum's twice annual water monitoring project. The forum just wrapped its spring monitoring session, sending six teams of volunteers to points all along the river and its watershed. So
some teams go out really early at like 6 a.m. and ride a boat out to some fairly remote spot in the river. And some teams are just almost walking out their back door to the docks down at the City of Kenai boat launch.
The idea is to have a simultaneous snapshot of the health of the river along those different points. And after taking samples, volunteers send them to labs where they're tested on variables like pH, temperature, and for the presence of metals and nutrients. The Watershed Forum's been doing that baseline monitoring since 2000, since the organization started. So there's over 20 years of data to look back on.
So anytime we're trying to understand something we observe now in 2022, we're looking back and comparing it against the last 20 years of data.
Sometimes that data results in action. About 15 years ago, analysis on the river showed an increasing presence of hydrocarbons, the pollutants that typically come from gasoline and oil. The main source of those hydrocarbons was identified as two-stroke engines from boats on the river. So the Watershed Forum and the Kenaitse Indian Tribe funded a motor buyback program. Boat owners could get vouchers for four-stroke engines, which have lower polluting potential, as long as they turned in their old two-stroke ones.
So after that program was implemented, within a few years, there was a pretty dramatic decrease in hydrocarbons.
Over the last two decades, the forum streamlined the technology it uses to take measurements. For volunteer Kathy Klein, one thing has remained the same all these years: the joy she finds in those twice annual monitoring days.
I still get excited thinking about it. You know, the first time going there and doing it, and always look forward to it. It was always a challenge, you know, to get to some of the areas.
Klein's been volunteering since the project's inception. Back then, they'd take measurements year round. She remembers wading into frigid water and seeing dead moose floating in the creek.
Doing the pH testing and the titration, and you felt like a real scientist and doing something good for the community and the river, which is a vital part of the community here.
This spring, she took data at Funny River, Moose River, and Morgan's Landing. The Watershed Forum office sits right near one of the sites at Soldotna Creek Park.
So we're standing a little bit further up on Soldotna Creek now. This is one of the sites that's been monitored for the last 22 years.
Monitoring starts with a quick check for any variables that might make this year's data different. This year, for example, there's a new fish weir sitting nearby. Meyer puts on gloves and takes several plastic bottles out of a cooler.
I'm going to have my field partner reach in and grab the first bottle. Usually the first sample type we collect is fecal coliform.
That's bacteria that comes from animal waste. Meyer wades over to the riverbank.
Then we would just swoop it into the water about 6 inches deep. and then try to get the line right kind of just above 100 milliliters there.
That's repeated four or five times, and then samples go to labs for analysis. The Watershed Forum logs its data online in an EPA database, along with data from watersheds all over the country. The whole process can take months.
Although there's only 2 days out of the year where this fieldwork happens, it's really a year-round project to keep going.
Meyer says they can always use more volunteers for future monitoring, like the session this summer. If you're interested in volunteering, you can email Ben at KenaiWatershed.org or call the Kenai Watershed Forum's office at 907-260-5449. In Soldotna, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. On June 11th, Alaska will have the first round of a special election to fill the open seat in Congress. Every Alaskan voter will receive a ballot in the mail. In the June 11th primary, you can only vote for one person. The ranking happens later. Pick your favorite candidate, sign, and get a friend to sign as well. Then mail it back. And remember that June 11th is the Pick One primary. This message sponsored by Alaskans for Better Elections.
The CEO of Alaska Airlines says the high level of flight cancellations since April will continue through this month. In a video message last week, Ben Minicucci said stability should return in June. He said the airline started April and May with 63 fewer pilots than needed to fly the published flight schedule. Management did not recognize the shortage until too late.
This error is having a continued ripple effect for May. Of the 1,200 flights that we operate every day, we've been canceling about 50 of them. That's about 4%.
He says the airline has centralized staff and schedule planning under one team. They've also prioritized hiring, training, and recruiting for pilots, flight attendants, and others. The cruise industry and several Pacific Northwest ports announced Tuesday that they are working together to try to eventually eliminate greenhouse gas emissions from cruising in the region. KTOO's Jeremy Shea reports.
Lots of partners are signing on to the effort to develop the world's first green corridor for cruise ships. It's a super early first step toward a goal they want to achieve by 2050. The idea is to work together to develop technology, infrastructure, and best practices so that cruises no longer pump greenhouse gases into the atmosphere that cause global climate change. Partners so far include the City and Borough of Juneau, the port authorities in Seattle and Vancouver, international shipping organizations, and the operators of almost every big cruise ship in the region. Jesse Fanistock is with the Global Maritime Forum, which works on maritime sustainability issues.
When Port of Seattle first reached out to us about this concept, we were very excited and quite frankly, a little surprised. We didn't anticipate, as we were working on this, that cruise would be one of the first mover segments on green corridors. But we very much agree, having looked at the concept presented, that this is a really promising opportunity. And if it can be done anywhere, it's here in the Pacific Northwest.
A single cruise ship can burn thousands of gallons of fuel a day. Kelly Craighead leads the industry group Cruise Lines International Association. She says CLIA and many other stakeholders want the United Nations International Maritime Organization to develop a massive research and development fund.
Carnival Corporation, Royal Caribbean Group, Norwegian Cruise Line Holdings, MSC Cruises, and many others are willing to invest deeply into these types of collaborative R&D funds because it is going to take that level of investment to be able to develop the technologies that don't currently exist.
Jan Swartz is the president of the Holland America Group, a subsidiary of Carnival. She says her company already has its own R&D team working on new technologies to make cruise ships more efficient and to use alternatives to fossil fuels.
We're really excited to bring to the table our learnings to share with others in the maritime sector and seek similar ideas from them so that we can accelerate our collective progress faster.
The structure and scope of how the partners will work on this green corridor still has to be worked out. An official with the Port of Seattle says he expects to get all of the partners together in the next 30 days to begin work on a charter for the group. Alexandra Pierce is Juneau's tourism manager. She says this partnership can be a model for the rest of the world.
We were the first port in the world to have shore power, and I think it's really appropriate that we lead the world in this too and continue to push the envelope on environmental policy and practice in the cruise world. Someone somewhere needs to figure out what the roadmap looks like to get the industry there.
Green Corridor Partners announced their collaboration during a conference on ports and harbors in Vancouver. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Denali National Park is still melting out from its snowiest winter season in 99 years of record keeping. According to the National Park Service, the agency headquarters received 176 inches of snow, besting the previous high mark of nearly 174 set in 1970-71. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the unusually heavy and late lingering snow is affecting park wildlife.
Denali National Park is resuming full summer operations as of Friday, May 20th, but Park Public Affairs Officer Sharon Steitler says conditions along the park road are lagging behind the calendar.
It definitely looks like winter when you're out at about mile 10 and you're looking out into the tundra. I mean, it's still very snow covered.
As of Sunday, there was still 33 inches of snow on the ground at park headquarters, by far the most on record so late in the season. But Steitler says the onset of warmer temperatures this week has accelerated melting.
There are more areas to be able to walk along the sides of the road, but we still have places where drifts were quite high or where we've had snow plowed. And I'm 5 foot tall, and some of those drifts are taller than me.
Steitler says the heavy snowpack dented some agency truck cabs and damaged a pedestrian bridge at Savage River, and more significantly, stressed wildlife, resulting in more animals on the road this spring.
Bears are using the road, as are moose. Last week, we did have a moose on the park road who gave birth to twins.
Steitler says the two calves have since died, noting that moose are in general very weak from the deep snow. But with so much still on the ground, the extent of the moose die-off is unclear.
We're anticipating more carcasses coming through as the snow melts. And we're keeping a close eye on it, especially if some of those carcasses are along the park road or in areas where we know visitors are going to frequent.
Meanwhile, a portion of the park road in the Sable Pass area has been closed to cyclists due to bear traffic.
We're having more and more bears show up along that stretch of roadway because that's one of the spots where they can go to dig up roots right now and get food. We don't want to habituate the bears to bicycles, and we definitely don't want anyone encountering a curious bear while they're out bike riding.
Park shuttle and tour bus operations resume this weekend, although they'll only be traveling as far as mile 43, where the road is closed because of the Pretty Rocks landslide. The park's visitor center will be open to the public for the first time since 2019, and sled dog kennel tours are resuming in what is the kennel's 100th anniversary year. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Claire Stremple and Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Izzy Ross in Dillingham, Sabine Pooks in Soldotna, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.